it's not time to panic, but it's definitely time to start acting. Like, now is a time where we need to start doing things because it is coming up on us.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join us as we delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver market insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit subscribe for your bi-weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid anytime, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the FCAT Crypto Brief. I'm Matt Allen. In this episode, I'm joined by Max Waddington, Parth Gargava, and special guest, Mike Daskal. Today, we're going to be diving into quantum computing, everyone's favorite topic, it seems, as of the last month or so. But before we do that, Mike, do you mind just giving our listeners an intro to yourself, what you work on, and what you do in FCAT?
So I'm Mike Daskal. I'm a VP of quantum technology over here in FCAT. And in FCAT, we have a team that looks at both the opportunities that quantum computing can afford us, can give us, as well as the threats that they pose, not only to blockchain, more generally as well. We're looking kind of at all the ways in which quantum technology are going to impact Fidelity investments and all of our customers.
Yeah, that's very exciting and very helpful for what we're covering today. So maybe we should just like lay the groundwork and talk about what even is quantum computing and what when we say a quantum computer, what are we talking about?
That's a deep question. So, I mean, without getting in the weeds, I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that quantum computers are computers that operate on quantum bits or qubits, and then you'll have a couple of different ways they might be described, maybe described as not being a zero or a one, but something in between, or being both zero and one at the same time. I mean, the ways that these things are described are let's say, formally inaccurate. It's a bit mean, but they're hard to grasp. At the end of the day, quantum systems live in states that we just don't experience in our world. Now, what this means is that these systems can be leveraged to perform certain tasks in new ways that, and I'm you can tell I'm hedging my language here, but that in very specific circumstances may be much more effective than classical computers. The famous case of this, which we're going to dive into today, is the ability of quantum computers to factor large numbers. So if you have a very large number, you can find its prime factors efficiently. I mean, there's an algorithm to get to the answer directly. And that's something that we can't do classically. And the fact that we've never been able to do it classically is why much of our cybersecurity has depended on the fact that it's nearly impossible to do. So bring that all together. Quantum computers can do certain things that classical computers probably, we believe, can't. And yeah, the famous example of the thing that they will be able to do that we can't do classically is factor large numbers, which means breaking all of our cybersecurity today.
It kind of seems like this whole quantum discussion just came about all of a sudden. Parth, I don't know if you or Mike wants to give some context in terms of like, why are we talking about this now? Every time I meet with clients or our investors or even internally, that's the question I know I'm going to get among others. And for a while, that wasn't really a question on anyone's radar. And it seems to be like the topic everyone's talking about now. So like, why are we talking about this now?
Yeah. And Max, maybe just to add some color to it, all this while, if you asked me this question 2 years ago on what are the risks of quantum computing, especially in crypto, I would just, you know, think about how this might be realistic in 5, 10 years, 20 years from now. But I think what's interesting is on March 30th, a few weeks ago, Google Quantum AI published a white paper with Stanford and the Ethereum Foundation. And that's what kind of reset this whole conversation. And Max, the interesting thing for me was the headline was that there is a 20x reduction in terms of the qubits required to break Bitcoin's cryptography. And before this, the estimate was in millions of physical qubits, and now we're talking about 500,000 of qubits. That was the aha moment for me to start paying attention to quantum again. So Mike, I'd love to know from your perspective on how real do you think this threat is? What are some threat factors here? Or, you know, are we just getting paranoid for no reason?
Yeah. So yes, there has been a lot of recent attention, and at the risk of making it sound like I'm putting down what you've said, I'm not. The increased concern for the day that we're going to have cryptographically relevant systems has been kind of around for, I'd say, about the last year, year and a half. And if you go back a little bit further and take a bit of a wider angle, but a couple of years ago, we saw a couple milestones that really seem to impact the timeline to getting what we call fault-tolerant quantum systems. I'll take a slight pause. Quantum systems are noisy. They don't like to stay in the state that we want them to be in. We also can't make copies of them in the way that we can copy classical bits. And so putting this together makes it really hard to build a quantum computer that is not noisy, that's actually useful. And in the past couple of years, we've seen real advances in quantum error correction, as well as advances in the algorithms, in this case for factoring. So as you just mentioned, Google's recent paper, that has shortened the timeline to when we're going to have quantum computers that will be useful for better or worse, right? For opportunities and threats. But yeah, looking specifically at the decryption, I do want to talk a bit of the opportunities too, but looking specifically at the threat of decryption and the increased concern we've seen recently, Google's paper did make a bit of a splash, but there have been papers in the last year that I think have been kind of equally important and went a little bit unnoticed. So for example, about a year ago, another researcher out of Google proved that RSA could be broken with roughly 1 million qubits, which is itself already a significant decrease from the original millions and millions that we thought were required. And these advances are the results of improved error correction. So if you need a certain number of clean qubits, we call them logical qubits, we used to think you needed many more of them to do anything, and the algorithms themselves are getting more efficient. So there has been a lot of attention in the last couple months, but it's almost attention that we in the community have been trying to raise for the past 12 months, because we saw this paper out of Google, we saw a couple other pieces, which we can talk about later on, and we thought, okay, it's not time to panic, but it's definitely time to start acting. Like, now is a time where we need to start doing things, because it is coming up on us.
So Mike, if I can double click on this, because I'd love to get into the specifics of what is that threat surface. Like, when we say quantum is a risk for crypto and finance, what are we actually talking about? Is it only digital signatures, or is it anything that uses ECDSA? Is it, like you said, all of RSA, or is it also the key exchange part? Like, what are things which people are unnecessarily being worried about, and which ones are actual threat surfaces?
Yeah, let's break this down a little bit. Especially because I realized earlier I sort of misspoke. I said it's a threat to all cybersecurity. That's not quite correct. As I mentioned earlier, the vulnerability that quantum computers introduce is the ability to factor large numbers, right? And this specific problem, or rather the difficulty of this problem, is what we use for today's asymmetric cryptography. So when we talk about cryptography, I guess there are kind of three things we should identify here in this context. There's asymmetric cryptography, which is cryptography, we often call it public key cryptography. So there's a public key and a private key. The public key can be out there, and then you validate by showing the private key or by proving with the private key. There's symmetric cryptography, which is more like, you know, having a secret key that's shared between you and other parties that you're trying to keep secrets with. So you and I have a secret key. I encrypt things with the key, you decrypt it with the key. It's symmetric because we both have the private key. There is no public key. And then the third one is hashing functions, which are, of course, very relevant in blockchain. Those last two, symmetric cryptography and hashing functions, these are not under threat. These don't depend on something like the factoring algorithm. It's just the asymmetric cryptography. And this is an important point, especially in the context of blockchain, because we hear a lot of, for being generous, misunderstandings about the threats. Particularly when it comes to things like worries that a quantum computer can kind of break the proof of work protocols because it can find hashes more quickly. And there is a sort of a route to that, but it's very unlikely. It's very costly. It's very time consuming. We're not really worried about it. The only real concern is in the asymmetric cryptography, which is in the wallet signatures, right? It's in the electrical curve cryptography that's used in blockchain. So yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because it is worth clarifying. This is not going to break the entirety of cyber security. It's not going to break the entirety of blockchain. It's just that one piece that needs to be fixed.
I think this is a great myth buster for me because I now, as you're talking about it, it makes me realize that quantum is not taking over Bitcoin mining then. Like that was one of the concerns which a lot of people talk about is will quantum computers take over Bitcoin mining and essentially win all the blocks, dominate the network? And it seems like that's an unreasonable.
So there is a way to speed up finding a hash in theory. The fact is that in practice, this is just not something to worry about, right? The speed up is not as big as, say, the factoring one. It's not an exponential speed up. It's a speed up that might be beneficial, and it's going to be very expensive to run. So you kind of figure, okay, you know, what can you actually get out of quantum computers if you're trying to break that protocol? Well, you need a quantum computer that will let you find the hash quickly enough to then lead the next block. It just seems unlikely, right? I don't want to say it's impossible because, you know, you say that, and then the next week you find out something else has come out. But it's not something we're worried about in the industry.
I think, Mike, the cynic in us went straight for the risks, but I'd love to talk about the opportunities of this technology. Where do you see quantum helping with crypto and finance?
So there are a couple areas where quantum computing has been proposed to be helpful to financial services generally and to blockchain. It's a bit of a touchy subject for the quantum community because at the end of the day, while we do have a clear line of the threat, there's still a lot of unknowns about the opportunities. And there is a global community trying to find algorithms and applications that we know will be advantageous to run on quantum systems. But this is a hard problem, right? Now, there are reasons to think that quantum computers will be good in certain areas just from the nature of how quantum computing operates, how quantum systems evolve in time, like how they behave. And the main areas here, the big areas for financial services and finance now are in optimization and machine learning. There was a discussion about simulations like Monte Carlo simulations. The reality is it actually falls into the same camp as trying to find the hash function. In theory, it's possible. When you look at what happens in practice, you're unlikely to actually find an advantage over classical systems, at least for a very, very long time. We're talking like generations of quantum computers that speed up significantly more than what we have today. So yeah, if we look at optimization and machine learning, there are some low-hanging fruit in the areas, right? So certainly in finance, we talk about portfolio optimization. When it comes to machine learning, we often talk about using quantum systems for fraud detection. And again, there are reasons to believe that they may be beneficial there, but it's a little bit unknown. Thinking about specifically in the blockchain context, it is discussed in terms of looking at arbitrage opportunities and other kind of DeFi applications, as well as maybe an ethical MEV. But there are a lot of unknowns here. And I think it really will depend on how things really develop in the algorithm discovery community. I am optimistic. I think that we're seeing some good indications that we're getting closer. And the community as a whole has sort of shifted the methodology in which it works, which is I think, going to lead to more fruitful outcomes. So we're kind of coming at problems now in a quantum-first approach instead of trying to fix the classical algorithms. That's hopefully going to prove more fruitful. Yeah, I don't want to sound skeptical because I'm not. But right at the end of the day, if you were to give me a quantum computer and say, you know, a fully full-scale, fault-tolerant quantum computer, I don't know what I would do with it, right? And that's kind of the elephant in the room. Yeah, I'll stop there.
I think the big question on everyone's mind is, when will you have that computer, Mike? Yeah, the Bitcoin kind of, you know, community historically has always been skeptical of kind of any innovation. The motto is kind of do, you know, as much as needed, but as little as possible over time. And that's kind of held true. And I think that fits well with like all the efforts going into quantum, because it is becoming, you know, a more real problem by the week. So like the skeptics that I hear is like, hey, we don't actually have a quantum computer that has enough logical qubits to perform, you know, any reasonable functions, as you mentioned. But we don't have that background of like all the research and all the acceleration paths, what the actual rate of change looks like here. So if you were to give us a range or a timeline, what would you say?
Well, you know, rather than just give a year, I think it's worth breaking down a little bit. It's not too difficult to start a if you know some of the basics, you can kind of start to read through some of the headlines and say, okay, what's really going on here? And this gets back actually to the point that was raised earlier, right? We saw this big paper make a splash from Google at the end of March. But if you look at its resource requirements versus the last paper that we saw in the area that was really important, it hasn't changed that much. So, okay, so let's break down what it takes to determine what's needed to break a cryptographic algorithm, right? There are three important factors here. So the first is the algorithm itself, and that's going to tell you how many logical qubits you need. The second is the error correction that's available, and that's going to tell you how many physical qubits you need per logical qubit. And then the third one is the hardware, which is going to tell you how many physical qubits you have. And we've seen advances in all three of these, right? So they sometimes do get kind of conflated. So for example, the most recent Google papers, both the recent one from March as well as one last year. I like the one last year because its title is, I'm going to get it. It's not going to be exact, but the title is something like How to Break RSA 2048 with a Million Qubits, right? Now, it does, and this is, it's good research, but keep in mind those three points that I just mentioned, right? We have the number of logical qubits needed, physical qubits per logical qubit, and physical qubits available. We can start to kind of skip the middle bit and just think about the logical qubits, because we're starting to see quantum computing companies release roadmaps that incorporates error correction into the planning. So if you look at just the logical qubit count, the paper last year says you needed approximately, I think it was 1,400 logical qubits to break RSA 2048. Google's paper has a path to break the elliptical curve cryptography with 1,200 logical qubits. And I think that's just because the key lengths are shorter. And then if you look at the existing roadmaps, I won't name a company, but the recent roadmaps have the availability of systems with roughly 1,500 logical qubits as soon as 2028. And this has been true since about last year. So that's actually not, so the paper that we saw a couple of weeks ago didn't actually change that, right? Now, 2028 might seem kind of scarily close, but I think it's also worth considering the uncertainty of some of what's going on here, right? So this is when we get back to 2 and 3 in that list. So we need the error correction to work well. We need the physical qubits to be present. And the roadmaps are making assumptions about both of those. I'm not putting a bet on whether or not the roadmaps that we're seeing are accurate, but I am saying the worst case scenario has 2028. And I think that we need to take into account that companies are let's say, often optimistic in their roadmaps, right? But let's take that 2028 as a worst case scenario. We now have, well, a little bit over a year and a half to get ready for this. And there are some contexts in which that's almost too soon, right? So there are some contexts in which, and you'll often hear about this in the discussion of post-quantum security, people worry about what they call the harvest now, decrypt later threat, where malicious actors just steal encrypted data and they just hold on to it until they can use quantum computers to decrypt those private keys and then access the symmetric keys and get all the stuff underneath. That is a bit of a worry for some contexts, but not many, right? And our research has indicated that certainly financial data is not a big concern right now. And I think that that's just because of the relative short lifespan of the value of this data. And that's particularly true in blockchain, putting that aside for a moment. Under the assumption that people are using the latest methodologies and sending transactions, the value of the private key is only as good as the length of the duration of the transaction that's being spent. So there's no point harvesting that data. That data should not be valuable later on. So really for blockchain, you need to be ready just before kind of Q-day arrives, as we call it. And given what we're seeing in the industry, I think that we're in a pretty good position right now. And that's, again, if the 2028 worst case scenario actually happens.
That's really good context. I think, like, personally, I get a lot of questions on how do you actually quantify, like, this risk, right? Because the range of probable outcomes is just so wide. How do you actually make any decisions based on the information we have now? And I think that's a really difficult problem to solve. But actually, as a response to the Google paper, it does seem like generally the Bitcoin community and other communities are taking like the worst case scenario preparation type of steps, right? Hey, we're not sure and we accept that, but we're going to prepare for the worst case scenario. Do you think that's prudent? And like, what are you guys seeing actually happening, you know, over the past year or even 2 weeks, has been quite lively.
I mean, well, so one thing we haven't spoken about yet, which will help kind of position that response, I think, is are the actual threat vectors. So there are two main threat vectors for digital assets when it comes to quantum. And these were identified in BIP 360, but they date back to earlier work that I think goes back to 2020, done by Eitan Barmes and some colleagues back when he was at Deloitte. The two vectors you can think of as attacking assets at rest and assets in motion, right? So looking first at assets in rest, these are assets sitting in a wallet where the public key has been revealed, is out there, and a quantum computer can access it and steal the wallet's contents. This is a problem that exists for old blocking scripts, so old wallets where the public key is just in public. In modern wallets, this is not the case.
It's not to say that it's not a concern at all. There is sort of still a threat there once you send a transaction. But there are some straightforward ways to protect yourself, you know, simple things you can do. And they are looking at how they can improve the blockchain to make it more automated and more secure.
There actually is a counter on a website by Project 11, which is one company that's looking at post-quantum security. And it's a company that Solana has been working with. And they show that roughly, I think it's 7 million Bitcoin are currently vulnerable. But if you own one of the wallets that is vulnerable, it's pretty easy to solve this. You just get a new wallet and put your Bitcoin there. There's a bit of a question as to the vulnerability of assets in other blockchains. So I know that Eitan's research was concerned about certain Ethereum wallets where the public key kind of remained out there because they didn't have updated locking scripts where it would get hidden. I imagine that's being updated. I know that Ethereum has been pretty vocal about getting ready for post-quantum. The other threat vector are assets in motion. And these are cases where a transaction is put to the mempool, the public key is out there, and then a malicious actor can steal a private key and front-run the transaction. Now, this is really interesting. It's a little bit harder to block. There are some mechanisms out there that I think will stop this. But the key point here is that the success of this attack depends on being able to decrypt and front run within the block time. And this is also important when it comes to the discussion of Q-Day and when we have to worry. I didn't mention it earlier. But when you look at the papers that estimate how you can break RSA 2048 with a million qubits, for example, the amount of time it takes to run that algorithm is about a week.
Now, things might get a bit messier for Bitcoin, which we can talk about too. But even if it's true that in 2028 we do have the first what we call them cryptographically relevant quantum computers, the chance that threats appear like on day one, on the day that the first of these systems comes online, it's pretty slim. But your question was about whether the reactions have been appropriately balanced.
I think it's generally been where it should be, which is we need to act now. We don't need to panic, as I said earlier. These systems will be coming. They will be coming sooner than we thought they were going to come, as Parth mentioned. I mean, your evaluation was totally right. You asked us 3 years ago. They weren't going to be around for a decade. Now we're talking a couple years away. But that doesn't mean we're at a position where we're not going to be able to secure everything we need to secure in time, as long as we start now, right? That conditional is important. We can't wait because it will take time to transition, and it's a difficult process, so we better get on it.
One question I have specifically about assets in motion, Mike, is in the Google paper, they did note that theoretically they thought it was possible to break ECC in 9 minutes, which would actually be within the average Bitcoin block time of 10 minutes. How do you think about that and kind of like first generation quantum relevant or crypto relevant quantum computer versus like second, third generation? Is this going to be able to be broken in 9 minutes right away? Or do you kind of handicap that ability to further down the line?
Yeah. So this is where things are looking a little bit messier for Bitcoin. So the recent paper does imply that certain kinds of quantum computers, the ones that they call fast clock quantum computers, may be able to break Bitcoin's cryptography in, I think it was like between 9 and 12 minutes, which in the average block time is 10 minutes. So it could pose a threat to assets in motion. I guess it's worth noting that this is exactly what Eitan, who I mentioned earlier, what his findings were. He had the same findings that Google reported, that Bitcoin could be a concern. He also looked at Ethereum, and I think this would be true of most other blockchains today. You know, it has the 10-second block time, and that's just not really a concern. Now, that said, if you look just at the roadmaps, so I'm not making a judgment call on the technologies or the companies at all, but if you just look at the roadmaps that have been released, it's looking like the first kind of cryptographically relevant quantum computers that we're going to see are going to be the slow clock ones. which are going to take much longer to run the algorithm. And I'm basing that on kind of the number of logical qubits and gates these systems should be able to run. So again, it's not that these are better building, the better ways of building quantum computers than others, that each modality, we call it, has pros and cons. I mean, in essence, you might think of the slow ones as being some of the first ones to come out, because what you're getting out of that reduction in speed is increase in stability. And so it's kind of easier to build fault tolerant systems, sort of. That's a little unfair, but it's kind of high level. So yeah, so the first cryptographically relevant systems, if they are slow clock, are probably not going to be a threat. So it will kind of be the second or third generation, once the fast clock cryptographically relevant systems come online, that we start to worry. I will admit there's one bit of uncertainty on my part, which is that one of the big slow clock, quote unquote, slow clock companies, I think does have a way to speed up their systems, but I don't know by how much. So it's definitely something we've got to keep an eye on.
Do we have to worry? We have to migrate, and we don't need to panic.
Yeah. We need to solve the low hanging fruit first, and then we can get to that problem later on.
Maybe Max, this is a good time to talk about BIP361's approach and how defensible it is. Because again, the larger question is, if you don't phase out the old signature types, you leave an attack surface which is permanently open, and a quantum attacker can essentially come in. Or the alternative is that let people migrate voluntarily forever, which also means that let a lot of Bitcoin eventually get stolen, maybe, right? So I guess I would love to know what's your take on freeze or steal. How is the community thinking about BIP361?
Yeah, just for our listeners, BIP361 came out, I think, this week as, the slew of research in the Bitcoin community has kind of begun working and begun presenting as a response to the Google paper. And it essentially comes in a few phases, but they're all designed to essentially limit the ability for users to either send Bitcoin to quantum vulnerable addresses or spend Bitcoin using quantum vulnerable signatures. And it's broken up in phases. The first phase is essentially, hey, we're not going to let you send Bitcoin to a quantum vulnerable address, which is namely those old address types, which are paid a public key. When you create them, the public key is exposed, right? So that's obviously presents that second threat vector, Mike, that you mentioned, where, hey, no matter what you're doing with it, if Bitcoin is in this pay to public key address type, somebody can extract the public key and therefore derive the private key. So that's the first phase. We're not going to let you send to that type of address. The second phase essentially just prevents you from sending Bitcoin using a quantum vulnerable signature. Right. And that's every single wallet type that we have today. And this kind of answers the question that nobody really wants to answer or hasn't attempted to answer yet, which is what to do with Satoshi's coins. Right. As a result of BIP361, Satoshi's coins and everyone else's coins in these old, locking scripts would be essentially frozen. Now, I will say, Parth, oftentimes the camp or the two camps that you'll find within the Bitcoin community are, hey, we should completely freeze all the coins. And that kind of aligns with the BIP361 proposal, or we do nothing and just let theft happen to those, unfortunate enough to have lost their private key or, maybe weren't prepared in time. But I will say this proposal kind of bridges those two camps. And I think that's really important. It doesn't provide the exact solution, but what essentially it says is, hey, we're going to freeze the funds for now and provide you some other way to prove that you are the rightful owner of the key and let you spend that way instead of using the typical public or private key, script signature that is typical with Bitcoin transactions. We're just going to do some other way, allow you to prove that you're the rightful owner, and then we'll let you send the Bitcoin. So I think it's promising. The exact solution wasn't identified and made clear in the proposal, but I think there's a chance that bridges these two camps, provides a more nuanced discussion.
Max, I almost think this is kind of a deeper issue where there's some genuine tension between decentralization and crypto agility. And as we all know, Bitcoin's governance is a feature. It's not a bug. It is to resist censorship and quick changes. But I think you do have this real time-bound existential threat to Bitcoin. And I think we'll find out real time on what the Bitcoin community values more.
It will certainly be an ongoing discussion, and we'll continue to cover it here. But I know that we are about at time. So, gentlemen, I just want to say thank you so much for this very enlightening conversation. And Mike, thank you so much for bringing your knowledge to everyone that's listening. And we'll keep everyone up to date on what's going on with Quantum, because there's certainly going to be more to come here.
Thanks.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, everyone.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution would or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2026 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.